Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? I always ask that of all my brethren. I just like the sound.
Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1989.
Baby fish mouth. Baby fish mouth.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1989, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1989. Here from, I didn't even think of a place because I'm here from the reservation in 2011. I am one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Phil Iscove.
And today we have Matt Zimmon and Craig Gerard with us to talk about a movie I am incapable of being objective about. I'll go ahead right now and let you know, Phil, this is a 99 for me. Major League, the finest American film ever made. Matt,
I like that we only have Matt and Greg on for sports movies, apparently.
Yeah.
Because they were on for Varsity Blues.
They're real sports bros. Look at these guys.
Yeah, a couple athletes. Bring on the athletes.
In peak physical shape.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to have to cut the short I have to get a lift in.
Matt and Craig, thank you for coming back on this pod to talk
about
the best. Best
movie. Pleasure.
I know that you guys, when we did Varsity Blues, we did our top five sports rankings. I believe you both had this is number one of all time sports movie.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
That was kind of the germ that made me think you guys should come back for it. But it is, it's also very much, I think this is very much in your personality and my personality as well. I think that there's something about this movie that I'm very interested in Phil's take on it, because Phil hasn't seen this movie or hadn't seen this movie in about 25 years, right? And I don't think that you
Correct.
Had. Yeah, and I think you've only seen it once. But I think for a certain section of people for whom the Venn diagram of TV or film and sports like intersect as your kind of two major things, this is as formative a movie as anything. And I also think this basically gave birth to the entire like – and I think this is metastasized in a way that's not great, but the entire like – sports take a complex, the entire Bill Simmonsization of watching TV, watching movies, talking about those things in a way that I don't know if there's really any other movie that has had this kind of effect on people while simultaneously having almost no effect on people who aren't part of the cult. Right? This isn't Bull Durham, where I think people who don't love sports love Bull Durham. People who don't love sports love Field of Dreams. But people who don't love sports don't seem to gravitate to this movie the way that people who do.
Can I just say that as I watched this film, I thought, man, Bull Durham's a really good movie. No joke, I thought that. And that's not a shot on this film. I'm just saying I think that speaks to what you're talking about, Kenny.
There is something about this movie that I think it translates to anybody, but for a certain type of person, and Matt and Craig, were you the type of people who were watching this well before you probably should have been able to?
I feel like I saw it immediately. I have an older brother, also a giant baseball fan like me, and so and this movie came out in 89. I'm sure I saw it in 89 or very shortly after, so I was 7 or 8 years old, probably the first time I saw this.
Me too.
And this was one of those movies that was on heavy rotation on HBO. Like back in the day, like there was like 7 movies that were just aired constantly on HBO, and this was one of them. So it kind of was ingrained in us.
And then also USA, because Tom Berenger's "Cut Your Nuts Off and Stick It Down Your Fucking Throat" line is in my head as "Rip your guts out and stick it down your freaking throat."
Yep.
And there's also and "Strike This Motherfucker Out" became "Strike This Guy Out." I remember loving that as a kid.
I know they never did the Lebowski cut with like, you know, this is why you don't fight a stranger in the Alps thing. They never had fun with it. but yes, it was on USA all the time. But yeah, there's something about this movie also where like dads, and I just did this with my 8-year-old, didn't seem to be upset if their son or daughter, but I think son, watched it well before they were allowed to, otherwise when it comes to R-rated movies. And this was like, for you guys, was this like a big sleepover movie for you?
I think this movie was a big everything movie. I feel like, you know, growing up, it was just something, you know, like I was a huge baseball fan. This was a movie where it was like, okay, it's all about baseball. And then not only that, but as a kid, it was also a movie where it's like they're cursing constantly. So I remember as a kid being like, this is a baseball movie, but it's a grown-up movie that kind of makes me feel like a grown-up. And so, and also just thinking, just from the start, thinking how funny every minute of this movie was. And I think that to your point, Phil, about Bull Durham, this was a rare movie of, for whatever reason, my parents let me watch whatever I wanted as a kid. And my dad was like a huge TV fan. My dad still watches more TV than I think any of us on this Zoom right now. He watches constantly. My dad is currently watching 45 TV shows. Nothing is off limits, except for some reason when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to watch Bull Durham. And I think it was because there's a couple sex scenes in there. I'm guessing there's some nudity in Bull Durham, right? Is there?
I think you see a couple.
But they come out within like a year of each other, didn't they? Is Bull Durham like 88?
Yes.
For whatever reason, I was not allowed to watch Bull Durham. Major League was, you can watch as many times as you want. I don't know the explanation for that. So for me, it became Major League was my favorite movie. And Bull Durham, I honestly probably saw like a few years later and I was like, oh, this isn't as funny as Major League. It is not on the same path. It's not on the same mind.
The funny thing about Bull Durham for me is like I've watched Major League more than any movie there is. I'm positive of that. I'd never watched Bull Durham until I was a little older. But my dad, I played catcher. My dad used to call me Crash Davis. Like, it wasn't like my dad, like, it wasn't like he wasn't into Bull Durham. Sure. Just for some reason, like, it just was not something that he brought to me the way he brought Major League to me.
Right. I mean, and for some reason, too, the only other movie I wasn't allowed to watch growing up, same time frame, was Full Metal Jacket. And the explanation, and the explanation was really, I think, I remember hearing, like, because there's so much swearing in the movie. And I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to watch Major League where they say, fuck you and suck my dick 40 times in the movie. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. So I can't really explain that. But that's just
I think one of the main things about Major League, because I love a ton of baseball movies, but like the baseball in Major League, like those guys look like they could play. And I think like I'm a huge Rookie of the Year fan. I'm a huge Little Big League fan. Angels in the Outfield, The Sandlot, all of, I mean, those are all kids' movies, but like even Bull Durham, like the baseball, it never really looks like great. It's like,
well, Tim Robbins can't throw a baseball.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Charlie Sheen can throw a baseball. And like like those guys can swing and like they look like a real team. And I think that really kind of makes you buy into it a lot more than, because a lot of sports movies, you just like suspend disbelief of like that these guys would be professionals or these guys are really playing. And I don't think you have to do that in this.
Charlie Sheen admittedly took steroids during the filming of
the
movie.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So he popped out and like he was throwing like 85 miles an hour. Yeah.
Like, at the height of that whole like Charlie Sheen going off the deep end publicly, like obviously that was like a ultimately very sad situation. But I remember hearing like little things which would be like he rents out Dodger Stadium so that they could he could play with his friends. And like I was like, well, that's kind of cool. Like I wouldn't mind doing that. Like he was like flying Todd Zeal out like to do to play baseball.
I love Todd Zeal. That's my man.
You know, so my history with this film is obviously quite different than you guys. I don't have the same attachment to it, and that's not to throw shade at it in any way. You know, I saw it once when it was a sleepover, as Kenny mentioned. I think I was probably about 10, something like that, 9 or 10, around the time it came out. I remember sitting there with like probably, you know, 8 or 9 other guys my age. They fucking loved it. I didn't get it. Like it's because I don't really have the same affinity to sports that a lot of people do. And I just remember being like, okay. And then I do think that I saw it again a few years later and I got the jokes more. It played a little bit more for me, but watching it yesterday, I mean, obviously it's an undeniably very funny movie. And I just think that without the formative kind of connection that you guys have to it, I do feel like I don't get the joke as much as
it's
other people.
It's probably alienating for you.
It's a little alienating.
Because I find so much of modern pop culture to be alienating because I wasn't there in the beginning, right? Like basically, as I've discussed on this Patreon podcast, my movie consciousness didn't start until 1989. So anything that existed before 1989, sure. I pretty much didn't see as a child, including Back to the Future, including Ghostbusters, including you know, movies from like Beverly Hills Cop, including Coming to America, Splash, like Big Little, everything in between. I didn't watch those movies until I was an adult. So all the discussion about those movies and a lot of discussion about like fantasy stuff like Neverending Story and Willow, again, like things that were these conversations are alienating to me. So because I didn't get it because I was too busy watching Major League 4,000 times. But when I watch those movies, I just judge them based on, you know, the merits. And like I think like Back to the Future is a masterpiece. And I think Goonies is something I just will never understand. But I understand where you're coming from, Phil. It's probably a similar thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I'll talk about like I don't think this film is perfect. So just for what it's worth, I do have some. I know. I do have some criticisms of it. But I also think that so much of this film is riding on, and we've talked about this in the past, Kenny, but like is the tone of it, right? I mean, it knows what it's doing. It has a very specific tone, a very specific comedic vibe to it. And if you're writing with that, then like getting into kind of nitpicky stuff, of which I have perhaps a couple, is sort of beside the point. Do you know what I mean? Like it's just that's not this movie. And that's why I feel like, you know, putting Bull Durham next to this film, I think does them both kind of a disservice in a weird way. Because I think that they're very different films. They're going for very different things. Definitely. And I think that they both succeed just doing completely different. They just happen to both be about baseball.
I mean, I totally agree with that.
They're very different.
Yeah.
Major League's not a movie. Major League's a vibe. and like, I agree with you completely. Like, I think Bull Durham, and I love Ron Shelton, obviously, like deeply. And I think Wet Man Can Jump is a lot closer to this than Bull Durham is.
Yeah.
Charlie Sheen turned down. He was supposed to be the Woody Harrelson role.
Thank God. Like, they were perfect together, obviously. But
And there may not have been a money train, so.
Yeah, we would have been without money train.
I've seen that many times, too. Major League is just a vibe. Like, it's almost not trying to do what Bull Durham does. I don't even know how to explain it, because it is structurally like, it's structurally sound as you can get. Every single character has their arc. Everyone has their flaw. Every flaw is resolved. There's a perfect little B-runner love story between Behringer and Rene Russo. You have the evil villain. Like, it works so perfectly, but it's not because of that. It's not even because of the jokes. It's just the vibe.
Can I ask a question to you guys, actually? Yeah. Do you think that this is the best underdog movie? Or certainly one of them, but do you think it's... Because like that is a trope, not a shot against it.
Phil, so of course it is.
Well, I think it might be, because I personally think it's the best sports movie. Like I really do.
I mean, I think it's without a doubt it's the funniest sports movie. There is not a funnier sports movie.
I should say best sports comedy for sure.
Because my question was going to be, and I have lots of them for you guys, in terms of like. Like, is this a accurate sports movie? Like, do you feel like, because it takes some liberties, right? Like, would they really bring in Welthing?
I mean, the biggest one pitch for one batter.
Well,
I mean, that actually is more relevant today than it was 30 years ago.
Yes, that is true.
My biggest thing on is this real was from watching it last night was. The character of the GM, who's like, you know, he's like our eyes and ears through like next to the owner, who basically is like, he's the good guy. He's kind of like, he wants to win and stuff. He literally does zero in the entire movie except react to her. And he's the GM. She's the one who invites everyone to spring training. She builds this team. She is responsible. It's her and Lou Brown that are responsible for the winning team that they put forth. And the GM literally does nothing.
You're right. Charlie does nothing.
Charlie does nothing except, I guess, he tells Lou what the plan was when there's 40 games left, when it's almost too late. That was like my one thing. I was like, oh, wait, he's the GM? Okay, I didn't really realize that as a kid. But, he doesn't do
it never struck
thing.
Me.
And he probably wins GM of the year. He probably wins GM of the year.
You're 100% right. Because who would put this team together? He definitely won. That's both.
And all the diamonds in the rough. It's true.
Yeah.
But how do you feel about the alternate ending or the shot ending have you heard of it? Have you watched it?
Of the wedding? Is the wedding?
Well, there's the wedding, and then there's actually an additional stuff they shot with, and forgive me, with Phelps.
Rachel Phelps. It would have been a nightmare.
Which basically shows that like it was all part of her plan and that she was trying to like which kind of rounds the edges off of her. It's better than just
cut.
Straight up villain.
It's a good cut.
Great cut.
What you're talking about, Matt, which is like, clearly there are things, and you see it all throughout this movie. This feels like more of a relic of its time when things were allowed to be more of a Shaggy Dog than they are now, where things clearly were cut and things don't quite make sense or haven't been established. Like, one is what you're talking about. Like, the alternate ending, or not the alternate ending, the original ending, was the idea that she had actually scouted all these guys and actually found all these diamonds in the rough and except Willie Mays Hayes, which was just a lucky thing that happened. And it's a disaster. But there are things like, for instance, did you know that Jake Taylor and Rick Vaughn live together?
Well, you don't know that. Yeah. You don't know that until the scene with when he sleeps with Dorn's wife. Yeah.
Yep.
Find that out at the end. It seems obvious to me at some point. They're like, let's three of us live together with Willie Mays Hayes.
Sure.
But it's not that important. It's just Shaggy Dog shit that, like, you get it. You can move on with your life.
Yeah. Completely.
In terms of, I want to get back to like the verisimilitude of this movie.
Ooh.
This movie to me plays more like a drama than a comedy. In that, there are really funny characters, right? But with the exception of Serrano, there is no one who I don't believe in this world once they get into this world, right? Mm-hmm. So once they get into this world, they fit, and all the jokes are incidental. There aren't really comic setups, with the exception of Serrano and the Joe Booth stuff.
Sure.
So it does to me play more like a drama. And what I mean by that is, yeah, I think this movie is a fairly accurate representation of what happens on a major league team with these particular colorful characters. And Matt, you probably had seen this movie I'm about to reference a million times. Craig, I don't know if you've seen it. Phil, you definitely haven't seen it.
Craig and I have seen all the same movies.
Yeah, we're pretty much
have you seen 1986, A Year to Remember?
Oh, of course.
I haven't. I have 10 copies of this in my house because A Year to Remember is the recap of the 86 Mets season where they won the World Series.
I have the music of it.
Once gave me a copy.
I had it memorized, Kenny. And then when I moved to California and my parents somehow they lost it, I tracked down a copy of it on eBay, got the copy, and then so I would never lose it again. Whatever show we were on, I took the VHS to the post department and said, "Can you guys please burn me 10 DVDs of this?" And then I sent them to various friends and family so they would also have it. And it
they're buried like all over DVD. The country.
Including me, by the way. One of my first – I met Matt and Craig 15, 16 years ago. We had a lot of mutual friends who were both out here doing the same thing. And one of our first conversations, I think, was about this particular video. And Matt told me the story. And then the next time I saw him, he came with a DVD, which I still have.
Fantastic.
The point is, Phil, for you in the audience, 1986, A Year to Remember, is the Mets recap video when they won the World Series. But it doesn't quite play like other recap videos where they just go through the games and go through the seasons. It's a real true documentary. It's brilliant. About this team that was a really unusual team because you had actual drug addicts who were also actually the biggest stars in sports, and Daryl Strawberry and Doc Gooden. You had Keith Hernandez who would smoke in the dugout. You had Gary Carter who was basically, to me, I think that's who Jake Taylor was based on, an old catcher, like still kind of trying to pull himself together, down to the hair with like a curly mullet. You had all these guys are on the fringes, like Lenny Dykstra, who wound up in jail for like stock trades, but also was like kind of a white Willie Mays Hayes, but also was kind of wild thing. You had these like eccentric relievers. And the point I'm making is like in that video, you saw things like the way they give each other hot foots, which is when you light, like you light something on fire.
They would take like a matchbook and like wrap it on like gum and put it on the back of their shoes in the dugout and light it on fire so their feet would catch on fire in the dugout.
I mean, and that was like never buddies are just lighting each other on fire type of thing, you know.
to what end? I'm unclear.
Just to fuck with them.
It's a prank. They actually had a section of this documentary thing that I watched ad nauseum teaching you how to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The two guys, Randy Myers and
Roger McDowell. Yeah, yeah.
We're teaching you how to do the hot foot thing. So you really got this. And then there was a book by Jeff Passan, The Bad Guys Won.
Great book.
Which was about this team when they won the World Series. So you really got the sense, to me at least, that there was a version of a Major League Baseball team where they were a bunch of colorful characters who lived to fuck with each other, fucked around on the weekends, all went out together, were willing to go to a bar and fight for each other. That happened all the time with this team. Like a big thing of them was like Ray Knight punching guys when he, you know, this. And I always felt that these Indians were based on those Mets. I don't know if you guys feel that way.
I think that could be true. But I think to go back to your other point too, is when you said that this feels like a drama to you, like I think without any bullshit, one of the reasons why I love the movie so much is that I think that most comedies that we grew up with and still watch and love are like, the stories aren't good. Like they're just, it's rare that a comedy has a really good story. And
not from the 90s and 2000s.
But I'm saying like it's not like the top comedies for the most part that like we grew up loving or like, I wouldn't say like the Ace Ventura story is like,
no.
Amazing. I love it, but I wouldn't say it's a like
really. Hold on.
But like, but Major League is like, if you took out the jokes, like, it would be like you're saying, like a dramatic movie that you could really follow along about a team of underdogs that come together and, you know, make a run for it. Like, I think that the story keeps you engaged, and then the characters are so well defined, in my opinion, that the jokes are all there. So it's like it just feels like a fully formed movie, more so than a lot of sports comedies or just in general.
Well, a couple of things on that. One is, I think proof of that is how well it played in an edited form, right? Because so many of these jokes rely on the language, but it still plays so well on USA, kind of with these jokes neutered. And another thing is, like, to me, and we're going to do, I think, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Phil. Is that right?
Ooh. Ooh,
Beverly Hills Cop 1?
One.
Beverly Hills Cop, Lethal Weapon, a lot of these movies that are funny, and Beverly Hills Cop is funny, Lethal Weapon, but they're both funny, are story first. Mm-hmm. Even Trading Places is story first. A lot of these movies in the 80s were story first. And that's kind of what I love about them. And the jokes are incidental and usually not that broad.
Yep.
That's another movie I love that I think flies without the jokes. But
I would also add that, you know, what really jumped out at me was the relationship between Taylor and Lynn. I mean, I think that Berenger and Rene Russo have tremendous chemistry, but also they just do. Like those scenes, you know, now might be tropey, I guess, but at the time, I mean, just thinking of there's a real nuance, there's a real sort of connection there. They're directed really well, they're written really well. I mean, I would say that sort of is the beating heart of the movie, and I understand why you pull the wedding, because you don't want it to shine too bright a light on that relationship and make it seem as though it's not about the team, because it's about the team, obviously.
But once he shows the ring, it's so
I mean, it's great.
I think that the best scene of the movie, I think also the funniest scene of the movie has nothing to do with baseball.
It's amazing.
It is when Jake Taylor shows up the first time he tries to find Lynn's place and it's her fiance's place. Yeah. That dinner party scene, everything is working in that scene.
Yep.
And everything is working in that scene. The unsung heroes of that scene are the other couples.
The old couple. Yes. Yeah.
The older couple
are amazing.
They might have
two
lines during that scene.
Yep.
Their looks are phenomenal.
The other woman is clearly thirsty for Jake. Yep. I love that.
There is so much happening. You find out their backstory. You find out what happened, really. You find out the relationship between him and the fiance. Right. It is such a killer scene.
So good.
Nothing to do with baseball, but it gets out everything.
And I would also argue that the button of the scene, which is him saying, stay away from her, and he says, suck my dick, is also a scene, a button that I don't think a lot of movies would go there. Like, they'd leave it in subtext. They'd be like, oh, these two are, you know, this is a pissing contest. To just put it out there like that also takes not just courage, but like, it's just, it knows what it is.
I
agree with you. It's one of the best scenes.
That scene in general is a little bit different than the rest, like, and not in a bad way, but it's a little bit different than the rest of the movie because so much of it just plays underneath. So then to go back to it, it just resets the tone in a great way.
Yep.
And honestly, what's funny too is, I'm sorry, but like, that actually, a big thing I noticed yesterday was like, there aren't that many long scenes in the movie. The first like 40 minutes, it's basically one giant montage. It's like until they actually make the team, I am on board for it completely. But they are it's back to back to back montages basically.
Yeah,
I'm in the 80s, I'm in the early 90s. This is what I'm watching here. But it's all fun and funny. And with that, right before they get into one thing that came up for me for sure in the beginning of this movie was during the pandemic. My wife and I have been ripping through so many different shows. One show in particular, we watched a ton of Cheers episodes, right? And I'm sure you guys are all familiar with the pilot of Cheers. It's with maybe the best pilot ever. When they're introducing the characters in Cheers, the introductions of those characters, within the first line of meeting all of them, you know exactly who they are.
Yep.
And you know what you're on board for. I think that the introduction of these characters in this movie do just as good of a job. You immediately, when they're pulling up the spring training, you know, or even when they're on the phone, when you meet Charlie Sheen and everyone, you know exactly who these guys are, and you know the ride you're going to be on, and you even know what their stories are going to be. It's wild.
I think that a look at this guy is one of the greatest introductions to any character.
That's what I was going to say about you guys. I was going to look at these fucking guys. I think that Lou Brown is brilliant.
Yep.
I think that the Lou Browns, I didn't even get this until I was older. But to me, the funniest scene of the entire movie is when Lou Brown gets the call and Charlie calls him and goes, "How would you like to coach the Indians?" He goes,
the delivery is unbelievable.
I don't know. and then he goes, "This is your opportunity to match with the major leagues." He goes, I got a guy on the other line about some white walls. I'll have to get back to you. So cool. And then when he's there, this line gets quoted a lot, but it's a perfect line. My kind of team, Charlie's my kind of team. It's like Lou is your guy. Lou, everything he does in this movie makes you love him. And the thing that I think this movie does so well is you have Lou and you also have Jake. And spiritually, they duplicate each other, right? They're both kind of washed up guys, never really like pulled it together, but they're not bitter. They've decided to shepherd this team of misfits. And I respect the movie for making that decision, because otherwise I don't know if I would be on board with these guys, particularly with where Jake winds up at the end with his move at the end, where he kind of sacrifices any chance of glory for the team. Back to the scene that you were talking about with the Mozart playing in the back in the group. Jake has one of my favorite lines for that character too. When the woman who's into him goes, "I hear baseball players make a lot of money these days." And he goes, "The good ones do." And she goes, "How much do you make?" And he goes, "I make the league minimum." With a smile, the slyest smile. And there's something about that where you still know, particularly because what he says about, you know, the 200 individual medley, you still know, even though he makes less money, he has everything on Tom. He is five times the man Tom is. And all of the normal metrics that people would use, big apartment, great job, classically good looking, listens to Mozart, has fancy parties, means nothing. Lynn is his. It's so good.
It's so good. And back to what you said about Lou for a second. And also with, like, you know, the Shaggy Dog stuff, just like not having to set up that they live together or anything. I feel like if this movie was made now, there would for sure be a scene after that Lou phone call where it would be Lou going back to his house and being like, "Oh man, you know what? I really should coach the Indians." And no, in this movie, it's just that's who Lou is. Yeah. But you know, he turned off screen, and that's fucking fine. You never question it. And I think it's just a great. I'm not sure if they wrote that and they cut that, but in my mind, I think they just wrote him like that, and that's just how it shows up in the movie.
I do think this movie, and this speaks to what you guys are talking about as well, like this movie is edited very smartly, right? Like they cut corners where they need to. They get you into scenes as quickly as they can. But I will say that it does feel like there are two scenes where when he shows up at the apartment, the boyfriend or the fiance's apartment, where I'm just like, so the elevator door just opens into this apartment. Yeah. So there's no doors. And then when he shows up at her apartment later, no locked doors. He just happens to be just he's like,
this was a different time.
Cleveland in the '80s had no locked doors. No, okay, that's right.
I think that's true. I
don't look it up. I'm pretty sure it's true.
These are things you just don't care about.
I didn't care. I noticed it. That's
because that music is so fucking good. It's like that song. The other thing about the fucking 80s is you could never have a song in a movie right now where the lyrics are sometimes you're just busy chasing after rainbows in a movie like this. And yet it's like when I hear that song, immediately I just want to go fall in love.
Yeah. I mean, what's so funny, I thought that they used music in a fantastic way in this movie and also a wild way in this movie. I feel like it would just go like, you know, there's an upbeat scene, they're playing baseball and they win the game, and then it just crashes into, okay, we're having a dramatic scene with here's Tom Berenger and here's Rene Russo, and it just completely flips. And I'm completely on board for it because I'm for sure biased in this movie, but I feel like there's very little quiet space in this movie. It is almost the entire movie is scored. It's entire it's just, I don't know. I think
the pacing of it is really crazy.
It moves, this is a product of like kind of having seen this 4,000 times and also feeling like I've kind of lived in it a lot. right? It's kind of a movie like me and my friends when I was real young, we would pretend to act it out.
Sure.
You know, that kind of stuff. And I've had friends go as wild thing for Halloween. This is more than just a movie, but it flies. Yet I feel like I know every beat of what happened in that season and in Cleveland while it happened, right? One thing I noticed this movie is just how great a job they did of showing the way the city changes when the team does better.
Absolutely. And that's a huge arc. And that's a huge
little thing.
The beginning of the movie is all just you're seeing here's a city that Cleveland is. This is what Cleveland is. And then you meet your three touchstones from it. It's like the construction workers,
the bar.
You meet the field crew and the guys. There's a third one.
Isn't it the bar?
Well, I forget.
It's kind of at the end, but.
Right. But like, I thought there was three scenes that they show it. And then you're following their like three moments of it. I think three times during the movie. Oh yeah. The fans, the three guys who sit in the bleachers.
Yes.
And I'll say,
the four people.
I also think it should be said too, that, you know, David S. Ward obviously wins an Academy Award for The Sting. And these are just really clean scripts. Like, he just understands just like screenplays so well that, you know, it's just, and to your earlier point about like, if it was done today, there'd be so much filler, there'd be so much shit in there because of a fear that the audience doesn't get it. Whereas like, you can see how much confidence he has in the audience understanding what's going on, and you can see the editing.
It's the lamest fucking impulse that you're talking about right now, because as you know, Phil, I watched this with Rollins, who's 8, and we all watched this when we were 7 and 8. Yeah. 8-year-olds never had a problem getting this movie.
Nope.
Right? Yep. Never, because it's obvious what's going on. I want to highlight, just because it is a perfect screenplay. I think it's incredibly well directed as well.
I don't know why he didn't win an Oscar for this one. If he got one,
I actually don't.
No, I'm serious.
What won in 1989? Did Rain Man win 1989?
No, 1989 was Driving Miss Daisy. Was the best.
That was adapted. Way funnier. This is way funnier than Driving Miss Daisy.
Way funnier.
So this movie starts with Burn On, the Randy Newman song, is an incredibly good song. Now, there's something about this song I find so perfect. It paints Cleveland as, all right, Cleveland, City of Light, City of Wonder, right? It paints Cleveland as a place where there are expectations on this city. But the city is actually about the song is actually about how the Cuyahoga River has a weird habit of going up in flames all the time.
Right.
Like that this city once was like a great beacon, like all the steel cities in the Midwest, right? Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Detroit and all that shit. But it's dying. And the song kind of speaks to that. And to start the movie with that song and end with fucking Wild Thing.
Yeah.
Like that fucking that trajectory. And end with a packed stadium and all these people who were like playing sad fucking stickball now dancing in a stadium with pink wigs on. It is like, that's the arc to me.
But doesn't it speak to the I mean, David S. Ward has talked about how he was a lifelong Indians fan. They sucked, and he thought the only way he was ever going to get to see them win anything was to make this movie.
Right.
So like, it does feel, and there's a negative connotation to fan fiction, but there is some component of him just being like, I won my Oscar. I'm going to make my fucking movie about the team that I love winning.
But there, by the way, David S. Ward of it all. Sorry. I would put his credits up against.
Yeah, for sure.
Any fucking screenwriter. I'd say that ever lived in a way. I mean, you look at his run and I'm like, oh, I love this movie. Okay. The Sting, very underrated movie from the early 90s that is a big Matt and Craig favorite, is The Program. It is not the same caliber as Major League from a story standpoint, but holy shit, he took a real swing in that movie to try and paint a picture of like big college football. And I mean, there are parts of that movie that really work. There are parts of the W not, but there are parts that really work. And I mean,
the one with the kids lying in the street?
Yes.
Yes, it was.
This is all to say.
I remember this was a hot ticket. My brother, because they edited that part out of the movie after a kid or multiple kids either died or got paralyzed. And I remember my brother coming in to the house one day. He was like, I got a copy of the original The Program. And the first time I saw the movie, it had that scene in it. I think it was like bootleg copy from the movie theater.
Oh my God.
And that's a very, very quotable movie as well.
This is all to say that Matt and I are going to write a Mank-like movie about David S. Ward eventually. It'll be black and white.
It should.
Yeah.
What are some other? He has a couple others that I'm like forgetting right now.
He has another movie that I love and think about all the time. I think about the program all the time. And I think about King Ralph all the time.
King Ralph.
King Ralph, sure.
Of course.
He wrote Sleepless in Seattle.
He wrote Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah,
he's got a hell of a run.
Oh, by the way, and I mean, you mentioned King Ralph. King Ralph, very possibly, and this is not hyperbole, has the greatest comedic cold open in movie history.
Oh, it's so good.
You guys, amazing.
Phil, are you familiar with the cold open of King Ralph?
I'm familiar with King Ralph, not familiar with the cold open.
The cold open of King Ralph is the entire royal family is all posing together for one gigantic portrait. There's like 80 people there. And because it's London, it's raining, and all they do is they give a little shot. It's like a tracking shot off of the family into the wire connecting to the giant camera, and the wire happens to be in a puddle. And so when they snaps the photo, the entire royal family gets electrocuted and dies. And that is the cold open of King Ralph.
That's brilliant. He is a genius.
David Ward is a genius.
That's incredible.
That's my kind of cold open.
Yep.
So let me, an hour and 15 minutes into this, give a synopsis to the people who might not.
We've been talking forty minutes.
Okay. So the synopsis of Major League is the new owner of the Cleveland Indians, former showgirl Rachel Phelps, played by Margaret Witten, has a sweetheart deal to move the team to Miami. But to break the lease with the city of Cleveland, ticket sales need to plummet. So Phelps hires the most incompetent players available, including near-blind pitcher Rick Vaughn, played by Charlie Sheen, and injury-prone catcher Jake Taylor, played by Tom Berenger. But her villainous tactics accidentally foster a can-do team spirit, turning the Indians into potential winners. Major League opened on April 7th, 1989, in first place with $8.8 million against the Dream Team.
Ooh, and 2020 Cyborg.
Here's what's also crazy. Rain Man was the second highest grossing film of the weekend, April 7th. So that movie played from December through April. That's how fucking ridiculously successful that film was. Major League would go on to make $49.8 million on an $11 million budget. It's got 83% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 84% from audiences. Roger Ebert did not review this film, oddly. Not really sure why, but he didn't. However, the New York Times said the film is so loopy that it glides over its cliches and indulgences in some congenial movie baseball silliness. And the LA Times said Ward directs his actors as adroitly as he has written for them, and the vulnerability that he allows the three stars to revel in is really what makes the movie work. You know, I think it's interesting that, I mean, here's a sports question for you guys. Why does it feel like there are more baseball movies than any other sport? It feels like baseball is more cinematic, perhaps. Maybe I'm drawing too much of a.
I think that might be something to be said about that. For the most part, at least up until recently, most of the screenwriters that had access to be able to make movies like this were probably older white guys, and they grew up liking baseball and growing up with baseball, and so that's kind of been their touchstone, and therefore that's what they're going to write about.
It's also it's a longer season, a slower game. I think that has a lot to do with it too. It's like, I think filming sports, baseball is probably one of the easier ones to film, right? Because it's like less movement in a way. Mm-hmm. You could have fat guys smoking and they're on the team and they're athletes.
Yep.
I think that has a lot to do with it.
I think there's also, there's a scene in a West Wing episode where Sorkin goes on this whole rant about how there's something about the incremental component to baseball as opposed to hockey, because he starts railing about how much he doesn't like hockey. But that's neither here nor there. My point more than anything is I do think there's something about – there's a lot of writers that I know anyway that will have a baseball game on in the background while they're writing.
Yeah.
There's something about sort of the pacing of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's meditative. It's meditative. It's, you know – the pitches, the count, all that sort of stuff feels very, very cinematic. Plus, it's also on this big scope in terms of like this big field and all that sort of stuff.
There's something. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, kind of a dumb answer too, but because it's a slower game and because of the nature of the game, it provides an opportunity to have people within the team comment on the game in real time in an environment removed from everybody else. So I'm basically talking about dugout culture. And I think there's something about dugout culture and clubhouse culture that makes it a little easier to write. But I think all the things you guys are saying, including the I do think it generally lends itself to different physical types of people, if that makes sense, than other sports. So I think that is a shorthand for some writers on how to draw different characters. And then I think a lot of it is what you're saying, Matt, which is just what these white dudes
there does feel. There seems to be a spectrum as well with the types of baseball movies that are made, as opposed to say the types of basketball or football movies that are made. The fact that you can have a Major League and you can have a Moneyball, that you can have a Natural and you can have a Bull Durham, like these are just vastly different movies. Yeah. Like, I just don't think that you have the same spectrum in other sports.
Well, there's also a religiosity to it that I would. It's kind of there in basketball with our new, you know, with this current generation. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of like this ball worship, this like round ball worship thing going on. But this has been going on in baseball for 100 years. It's the reason Field of Dreams works. Field of Dreams could never work with football. It just doesn't make any sense. It's just
I think too. I mean, outside of Moneyball, all those movies were, you know, 30 plus years ago. And at the time, baseball was the number one sport in the country. I mean, now it's number three. I mean, basketball and football for sure.
What was the last great
baseball in America? Was that because of the lockout a few years ago? Did the lockout?
I mean, I think it's a lockout, but I think it's just more that just kind of. I mean, the lockout definitely hurt, but I think it's just like
25 years ago.
I think it's just everything. I think it's like basketball and football are just faster, and they're just like, you know, they're more exciting for some people. I think that also. It's something where if you don't grow up with it, it's hard to kind of get into baseball. I think. I mean, I grew up watching baseball every day.
What's your relationship with baseball right now?
What's that?
Because I know you both played baseball.
We played for a long time until we could not play anymore. And now, like you said, like when we write and stuff, we always have baseball on. I think like whenever it's on.
Yeah, baseball is always on, and my kids are like, you know, I make them kind of watch it with me, and then they kind of like come back and forth with it, but like. They definitely, my kids definitely, Mets are still my team for sure. But I will say that like my kids definitely seem to just in watching it, you know, during the pandemic and stuff, because they're six now. So they're paying attention more and stuff like that. They definitely like the faster sports better. They like watching football more. My kids like watching basketball because they're scoring so much and stuff like that. They respond to that more, and, you know, kind of just going to follow that. But
I mean, I think it's, Kenny, to your point about Field of Dreams, which is also an 89 movie. Like, just look at that. Just in 89 alone, you have Major League and Field of Dreams, two movies that people fucking adore,
right?
Understandably, but just for completely different reasons. You know, I mean, one movie is the movie that is going. I mean, I don't think that Major League is just going for laughs, but like some might argue that the laughs might be paramount. And then Field of Dreams, which is just trying to make you cry.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
What do you think is the last great baseball movie, like that's been out in the last 10 years? I don't even know.
I mean, I liked Moneyball. I don't think it's like
Moneyball.
I don't think it's like a rewatch. If Moneyball is on, I'm not really excited.
You don't
to watch
like Moneyball,
it.
Craig?
I think it's fine. I think the pinnacle of that movie is like a at bat by Scott Hatterberg. I'm pretty sure, which is just like I'm never going to be crazy about.
I always felt the same way about that movie. All right, so I liked the book, obviously. I thought the book was kind of revolutionary. But, and I've said this to Phil before, the big thing in the end was they had a 27-game regular season win streak. Who the fuck cares.
There's no stakes in the movie. I saw it once.
I saw it once and I liked it because it was about baseball, I guess. But like, I've never felt the need to ever watch it again.
Hold on, I don't think. No offense, though, I don't think people understand how emotionally manipulative that is. Because in real life, that doesn't matter. And on top of that, that's not what the book is about. The book isn't about coming up with some big fucking win streak. The most amazing part of the book was Billy Beane freaking out in the luxury box how the playoffs, you know, are a crapshoot. Like, there's so much more than, like, fitting in these typical sports movie rhythms to that, that I felt manipulated. I mean, I felt like I could see through it. But, like, I don't give a shit about a regular season win streak.
Well, okay. I'm going to defend Moneyball here a little bit. As someone who doesn't care as much about the sport as you guys, the movie really works for me. I've rewatched it many times. I think it's one of Brad Pitt's best performances. I think he's stellar in it. It's him leaning into being a movie star for the first time in a while, since at that point he was sort of, you know, pushing back against it. But that being said, the movie itself, Kenny, to your point, I mean, the stakes of it are Billy Beane. I mean, the stakes of it are whether or not his team is going to succeed or fail. So there are stakes to it. Now, whether or not that win streak is as fundamentally important to a layman as myself is meaningless to me. I don't care whether or not I'm supposed to care about the winning streak or not.
Do you think, but in the end of the day, do you think he succeeded or failed? Because it's more complex than that. It's more complex than... then he just has this winning streak, therefore it should be read as he succeeded.
Sure, but you got to hand it to Zalian and Sorkin for trying to find a fucking story out of a book of statistics. I mean, that's a hard book to adapt.
They made that book into a
movie. I would agree with that.
To a good movie. Off of what you said, though, of Brad Pitt leading into the movie star of it all, it brings me to just watching that movie, because by the time this movie came out, Major League, Charlie Sheen was already a movie star, right? He was in Wall Street.
Yep. He was like third build or second build.
Third build, right? In watching this movie last night, you forget how fucking winning Wesley Snipes is. This movie and seeing him, I was like, oh my God, you can just tell this guy is going to be a fucking star. And there are these little tiny moments. He makes like these even little sounds about like, and like give these little looks. He's so winning. His smile is fantastic.
It goes right to Wesley's head because he doesn't do the sequels. It's like
completely.
By the way, good for him. I think Major League 2 is like borderline unwatchable.
Agree to disagree.
I think it's all right. We can talk about it later.
To be fair, Kenny, Major League 2 came out right in the sweet spot of we were probably like 12 or 13 where. It was impossible to go to a movie and not come out and without thinking that was your new favorite movie.
There was no movie released at that time that wasn't an amazing movie.
I think Major League 2 is fine, but I think
if I watch it right now, I would not enjoy it. But I definitely enjoyed it when it came out.
I think I also can enjoy it.
Wait, hold on. It was about Berenger and Charlie Sheen. I think what's really interesting to me, I never knew this as a kid, obviously, they were the stars of Platoon together.
Yes.
That movie won Best Picture. Berenger was nominated for Best Supporting Actor in that movie.
Really?
This was not an insignificant pairing. And it always felt to me like this was a movie that no one that belonged to nobody. Except to me and my friends and people I knew. But when in fact, it seems very clear to me that this was a big movie at the time with big stars, you know, like really trying to make a lot of money with a pretty big director on top of that. So that was kind of a surprise to me as well. But I thought Berenger, and I think Berenger is out of control in this movie. I think he is so fucking good. I think he is such a leading man.
I think he's the opposite. I was like, very much going to put on that.
I think he is a 10 out of 10.
Agreed.
It is as good a performance as Kevin Costner has ever given, and Kevin Costner is my favorite movie star ever. So, like, I think he just nails every little fucking nuance of this performance, allows the funny guys around him to be funny. grounds the movie in itself mm-hmm. and plays the romance in a way that most actors would be too embarrassed to play.
I want to talk about Behringer for a second here, because like we're also, this is him in the pocket, right? So he's got the big chill in 83. He has Platoon in 86. He's got Major League in 89, Born on the 4th of July in 89 as well. This is him at sort of the peak of his powers, if you will. And it kind of gets away from him from that point on. but at that time, there's kind of no one, to your point, Kenny, doing what he's doing. Like, I think that Costner sort of
He's getting there.
And Costner, I mean, Costner is in Field of Dreams in 89. So it's not like Costner isn't a movie star at that point. He is. But like Costner is a softer version of Tom Berenger. Like Tom Berenger is a little bit dangerous, which is why he's great. But it's also why I imagine, you know, the career that this just didn't happen.
It's a good point, Phil, because this and Crash Davis are very similar.
Yeah,
but Crash Davis is about as hard-edged as Costner gets, whereas this is about as soft as Behringer gets.
That's
correct.
Wow, good call. Yeah.
And Behringer in Platoon, which I watched recently, I mean, is fucking scary. He's a scary dude. Anyway, sorry, man.
Well, Kenny, I think that you hit something that I agree with too, in the sense of growing up, this movie definitely felt like it was something that like it belonged to like my brother and I and my friends, and we had this movie. And then I remember a moment in college, and Craig, I'm going to throw this to you for a second, because Craig and I went to college together, and we took a bunch of, you know, writing classes and movie classes and stuff like that. But Craig, you had a class. Was it a writing class, or what was it, where the teacher for the entire semester or just a brief thing taught the Major League script?
Yes.
Really?
Okay. So I later found out that this was his first class teaching, and that he was.
I didn't know that part.
Yes, he was a journalist, a successful journalist, I believe from Cleveland, but I might be making that part up. Who had come back to Syracuse to get like his doctorate or something, and for part of that program, he had to teach like you know an undergrad class as part of his thing, and he taught. It was basically like an intro to film class in a way that was like all he did was use Major League, and it was to show writing, to show like great writing, Major League, to show great lighting, Major League, to show great directing, sound. Like he just used it for Major League.
That's genius.
And I remember being like, and I love Major League, obviously. Here I am talking about it. But I was like, my major is a joke. this is crazy. It's one of my favorite classes I've ever taken because I was totally on board and I totally agreed with what he was saying. But I was like, I don't know if this is up to like scholarly standards, maybe, but it was great.
That's pretty funny.
That's amazing. Can we? So I want to quickly talk about Charlie Sheen for a second here.
Sure.
He comes to prominence in 86. Which is Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Lucas are the two sort of smaller roles that he has, and he has Platoon in 86 as well. So he really kind of like that's when he becomes who he becomes. 87 he does Wall Street, 88 he does Young Guns, and then 89 he's doing Major League. So he's the lead of Wall Street, but like it's an ensemble, obviously, and he's in a bunch of ensembles. It really, I guess, isn't until like the 90s, I guess, where he's like doing Men at Work and The Rookie and Loaded Weapon and Hot Shots, where he starts to become a little bit more of a leading man, I guess. I don't know.
That also seems like when it fell apart, you know?
Hot Shots.
Hot Shots is very good.
Actually, Loaded Weapon is very good, too.
there is something about the guy from Platoon and Wall Street doing over the top spoofs of Top Gun.
Which
Major League puts him in that conversation, right? I mean, he's not like I guess is a bigger question to you guys about Major League. He's kind of playing the straight guy in this. Like he's not really playing jokes, right? Like
it's attitude.
He's playing an attitude. Immediately they're like, he's a guy, you know, he's in jail. He has a great early line in this movie of when they're at the when they make the team and they go to dinner.
I love that.
It's Behringer, Wesley Snipes, and Charlie Sheen. And the first time he spots Rene Russo, Behringer, he says, "You know her?" used to be my wife, and she know it. Who's that guy she's with? And he says, "Want me to drag him outside and kick the shit out of him?" And that's just like, and then Berger doesn't answer, and he goes, and like he just knows. It's just a great. It's a great delivery. It's a great moment for him.
He also has. I thought an even funnier line, for what it's worth, earlier in the scene where he's wearing a tie with no shirt.
God. Oh, like God. It's so, it feels like a banker. Such a good line. I look like a banker. But do you, I don't know if you also notice. I also know if you don't also notice about you start this scene on a three shot with the three of them looking at their menus, and a good two and a half seconds pass before he turns his menu over.
I think it's longer than that.
It's long enough for like to realize. Then he goes, "What language is this in?" It's so cathartic and fulfilling. It just is like puzzle pieces in place. His relationship with Wesley Snipes.
Yeah.
Little moments. The clapping after Berger pretends to hit the home run. Beautiful. Beautiful foreshadowing as well, like good work there. But the clapping, the make fun of it—that's how you know it's like there are sappy elements in this movie, but they're not taking themselves too seriously. That like you have to be embarrassed for watching this movie.
Yeah, it's a loose movie. The movie is loose, and you're on the board with the ride. And like honestly, I think that the ending, the last game, is equally like tense and exciting. And I remember I've seen this movie countless times. The shot outside the stadium before it even starts and the music kind of kicks up, I get chills with it.
But that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's why I think it's so good, because for me, the comedy is amazing. I think it's one of the best ones, but you still feel that watching it, and that means it's just a great story. Like you're on board.
And that gameplay, like the stuff they're showing, they only show you the bare bones of what you need to know so you can follow along with the game.
And that music.
The music is incredible, and
I would also say too, you know, on the Berger of it all, you know, and I guess to Taylor's character, this idea of a guy, we meet him in Mexico, he's obviously, you know, been kind of thrown
also asunder. One of my favorite lines, I've used it for a fantasy football team, is that you, Tolbert? Because the Chargers used to have a running back named Mike Tolbert. Yep. And you know, you Tolbert.
There's something about the guy who knows this is his last chance. Like I think about the scene when he confronts what's his name? Dorn? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, Roger Dorn, yeah.
When he confronts him and says, like, this is my fucking shot. This is my last shot. These are some young guys, maybe their only shot. And I'm not going to let you fuck it up. And then you see him trying to get his ex-wife back. Like, this is just a guy who's holding on by his fingernails. Yeah. And then at the end for him to point, it's just fucking great. Like, it's fun. Like, it's just, it's great stuff.
I've seen this movie so many times, and this is probably the first time I've watched it beginning to end with a critical eye.
Uh-huh.
And one thing I did kind of recognize is that one of the first things I said is just how clean most of their arcs are, how clean, you know, just the baseball part of most of their arcs, right? The Willie Mays Hayes, you know, thinks he's a power hitter and eventually embraces his speed and hits the ball on the ground. You know, Charlie Sheen doesn't want to be helped, doesn't think anybody can help him, eventually embraces his glasses, learns to find the, learns to find the strike zone. Roger Dorn, none of this Olay bullshit, eventually learns to, you know, get down a field of grounder. Serrano, you know, relies too much on voodoo, like straight up, eventually says, fuck you, Joe Boo, I'll do it myself, and he does it. I was like, what is Baron? I'm really going to take a moment to key into what the protagonists, what Berger's kind of storyline is here. And it's what you said, because at some point he says it, you know, it's so classic, and this is why Craig, your teacher, taught it. She says to him at some point, the neighbor so early on says to him, you're just the little boy who would never grow up. And later he says to her, I'm just trying to pull my life back together. And then the end with her at the ring and him holding it together, and he's in the middle, like his two sons are on the bottom doing the handshake, and his father's on the left side, and his shitty brother's on the right side of Roger Dorn, and his crazy nephew is Pedro Serrano over there who had to bring a bucket of chicken to. It's just something so perfect about like the Berger of it all.
Yep.
The Jake Taylor of it all. I'm crazy about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think that Lou Brown sets it up immediately. The first second you see him when he's catching, he says, "You're the catcher of this team. I need you to be the leader." And the rest of the movie, he is the wisest player. Yep. He's the one that he saves the day with Serrano with a live chicken. He helps Charlie Sheen out. He gets Dorn on the straight and narrow. He is the guy. He is like the older brother that's just like, he's the leader. And I think they did a great job of showing that. And Berenger just fucking crushes it with it.
Can I have to bring up one thing that bumped me a little bit. I agree with everything you guys are saying. This is all great stuff. But I have just one slight bump, which was, I don't know that we needed Dorn's wife and Charlie Sheen having sex with her. Like, it feels a little shoehorned in there.
It's completely shoehorned in.
That kind of comes out of nowhere a little bit for me. We didn't need it.
I think it was just an extra little thing of like what can go wrong before the big game.
Yeah.
Because right now the he's going to sacrifice a live chicken isn't like big stakes. It's not really like, you know, anything. So it was basically a pouring on kind of thing, because it really comes out of complete nowhere, because that was in Kenny with the critical eye of watching this movie, the critical eye for the first time, besides the general manager doing nothing. My other two tiny takeaways of this was ridiculous was, one is they would never show the after party of a game and the players eating together, let alone having a guy hooking up with somebody in the background. That was wild. But the more egregious thing that of this movie where I was like just blown away by was, did anyone catch when the first time he follows Rene Russo home to the apartment, anyone catch what her license plate was?
Reed.
Her license plate is R-E-A-D. She works in a library. She likes books. Her license plate is
books
Reed.
Are my life now. Well, that is the worst line of the movie. Books are my life now.
Yeah, that's not great. But I will say to the point about Dorn and Charlie Sheen, the one thing that I always did think was cool with that story was the very end when they're celebrating. He punches him in the face and then they hug. Right. I was like, that is a great little moment of just like, you get who those guys are.
And that's a great piece of acting by Charlie Sheen, because he gets punched in the face. He gets up. He doesn't know if Dorn's going to punch him again. So he gives one of these but then Dorn brings him in for a hug.
Yeah.
And honestly, that really, I mean, actually now I'm going back on it, on the idea that it was shoehorned in the sense that that was
that's a good moment.
The rivalry. And they do come together at the end. So they do have a moment of the wife part is shoehorned in, but they had to have some kind of resolve of like, they're on the same page.
You know what? You know what? I'm sorry to just go, if we're talking about bumps in the movie, this actually bumped me when I was a kid, was when they're in spring training and they're all in like the barracks bunk together. Like, because you brought a Full Metal Jacket. It basically looks like they took a set of Full Metal Jacket and put it in. And I was like, I don't think that all these baseball players live together. It's not sleepaway camp. Like,
maybe they did 40 years. I don't know.
There are a couple things like early in spring training. I want to get back to this Dorn thing, but there are a couple things early in spring training that like I've always been like, you know, a little Pine Barrens-y, and that like, you know what I mean? Like there was more here, wasn't there?
Yeah.
One is like when they pull Willie Mays Hayes out of the spring training. They hold on the guy who's on the bottom bunk.
Yeah.
Who is not a guy?
Not a guy.
And then there's like the heartbreaking moment with Gentry, where Gentry gets the red tag.
Yep.
And like that, I think there's something in that moment that's actually instructive. Like, I think, you know, I want to say it would have been a little maybe better, or maybe it was intended or conceived as we learn we beat Gentry before. But the moment is so powerful, even if you don't know the guy.
Yeah, it's true.
Like, what a piece of extra acting out of Gentry.
I thought the same thing.
Like, so the thing about the Dorn moment that I wanted to hit on. So watching with my son, and again, these are things that like you pick up on when you're 8. Something he said was, "I love how everybody has their rival." Mm-hmm. Right. So I love that there's a Serrano thing with Chelsea Ross with Harris,
an absolute unsung hero.
Oh my God. Incredible. Amazing. How did we not talk about Harris at this whole point?
Are you telling me Jesus Christ couldn't hit a curveball? It's one of the great lines.
he might not even have a straight line in the whole movie. He might have a I think when he gets pulled in the last game, he has a straight line. Everything else, he has home run jokes throughout the entire movie.
It's absolutely amazing.
And I want to get back to Harris in a sec, but so there's that that's kind of like playing on, you know, kind of playing a very heightened level, which is beautiful. And then the Dorn Vaughn thing, which is like full of pathos. There is a lot going on there. And I think that whatever it took to get to the moment where Rick Vaughn goes right out to the pen, you had that beautiful shot of him watching from the bullpen, from under with the scoreboard above him, with him being, you know, just pulled from the game, or it was supposed to be a start. He didn't get the start. He's just watching. Jake tells him to go there to avoid Dorn, which is super important. Him getting called in as Wild Thing in this very critical moment. And the thing he does is look over at Dorn. And then you have Jake looking at Dorn. What are they going to do? Dorn takes the ball. And his line is the best line in sports movie history. Period. End of story. That's it. That's my rant.
I mean, I think that whole 3-minute segment, because they play almost the entirety of the song at this part of the movie. And I wish it was twice as long.
Yeah.
It is such a fun moment of this climax of this movie. And mind you, I think it's only, is it at the top of the ninth? By the way, what is Harris still doing in the game, by the way?
Unbelievable.
Harris is working on a 7-hitter.
He scattered 7 hits.
In today's game, he would have been pulled after four.
Four. Yeah. Well, he's also 60 years old.
That's why I'm saying, yeah.
I looked it up. I think he was like 46 or 47 when this movie was shot. He's probably on his 165th pitch.
Yeah.
By the time he gets pulled. And Dorn coming in, this whole moment. I'm sorry, Vaughn coming in and the scene with Dorn. You want nothing more than Vaughn to just throw 3 straight fucking heaters and strike out
Clu Heywood.
Clu Heywood, who's played by a former major league pitcher, by the way. I think his name is Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's phenomenal.
You're a Yankee fan.
Yes, sir.
So you've actually, like, Matt and I never really have experienced it the same way, but that's what it was like probably when Mariano came out in the ninth and Enter Sandman started and the whole stadium just started going. You had like 15 years of that. I think we had like fucking K-Rod and Gasolina for a year. Like
it is as close to that as you can come. And like, especially like early on when as a Yankee fan, when like 96 and you know, like 98, 90, like those years, like when Mariano was first like really coming onto the scene and you were like, this guy is special. That's what it felt like. Not quite as cool as Rick Vaughn, probably, but
I read about this movie that kind of the Vaughn coming to Wild Thing, like wasn't a thing. It wasn't a thing.
Yeah, the songs weren't a thing. Yeah, yeah.
This like started the idea of closers coming in and having like theme music with like, I think like Trevor Hoffman and Mario Rivera and like Gagne with his
Mitch,
run with the Dodgers.
Mitch Williams came into Wild Thing, and Mitch Williams Phil was the guy who gave up the home run to Joe Carter.
I know who he is.
Yeah, so that kind of blew it for a little bit, but yeah, the coming into the wrestler entrance music is necessary for a closer now.
Absolutely.
So speaking of actual players, this will mean more to you guys than it did to me and perhaps to our listeners, but there were some players that actual major league stars that David S. Ward was inspired by for certain characters, apparently.
I did not know this.
So Serrano is partially based on Orlando Cepeda and Wade Boggs.
And Wade Boggs. Oh, chicken. Remember?
Yeah. Notorious.
That seems like a bit of a stretch. He like
the notorious chicken eater.
Willie Mays Hayes was based on Ricky Henderson.
Ricky Henderson, yeah, for sure.
Ryan Duran is what Ricky Vaughn is based on.
I don't know who that is.
Eddie Harris, lead singer of
Duran Duran.
I don't know. Eddie Harris appears to be based on Gaylord Perry.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Gaylord Perry.
Yeah, I think Gaylord Perry got suspended a bunch of times for like putting shit on the ball.
Yeah, he puts snot on the ball and stuff. Yeah, that was him.
So that that brings me to my next point. So Harris's main character trait is that he puts bullshit on the ball.
Correct. Right?
Barbasol, Vagisil. Sometimes he just rub his nose if it's not on the ball. This leads to two great jokes. One is just in the montage, in a montage of them getting better.
I'm sorry. Montage one or montage two?
At least montage 14.
Okay.
Euchre just, and we'll talk about Euchre in a second, just deadpans Vaseline ball. That's still part of the fun of the movie. That's the scene when Jake sees that's right before the scene when Jake sees Lynn in the stands.
Right?
Yeah. All right, so Vaseline ball, like throwaway joke. The next one, in the middle of the fucking big game where there are no jokes, Euchre goes, KY ball. Nobody even notices. Like, you don't even notice it's happening. We're like,
can we talk about Bob Euchre for one quick sec? Because Bob Euchre.
I wanted to go to Euchre.
Bob Euchre has absolutely phenomenal lines. Obviously, like just a bit outside, very quotable among a thousand quotes of this movie. Bob Euchre is the reason, the main reason why Major League 2 works better than you think.
Yes,
because they realize that Bob Euchre is a fucking star and should be just. And they gave you three times the amount of Euchre in Major League 2 as it is in Major League 1.
But one of the things that is I'm realizing, not that you needed to convince me, is Major League is so much better than even I thought it was. And it was already at my top because we're an hour into this and we just mentioned Harris and we just mentioned Euchre. That's unbelievable. There's nobody better in this movie.
So Euchre is without Euchre, this movie, you know, is still like a 99, one of the best movies ever made. But he's actually the only like play-by-play guy who at this – because he's been a play-by-play guy for 50 years. He's the only play-by-play guy who at once feels like a play-by-play guy, also moves the story forward because he tells you every little bit. Like the Duke's coming in. He threw his own son at a game. Now I know what the Duke's about. Yep. You know, like little things like that and is funny as shit. Like he and I actually think Monty's like the greatest straight man because he has Monty can't respond to some line. And you can go, that's why he's the best colored man in the business, folks. A line I throw out all the time. When people have some shitty fucking retort, that's why he's the best colored man in the business, folks.
I also say
tremendous.
That Euchre also does sort of threads a needle in terms of the comedic tone that he, cause like there's almost an Airplane Naked Gun kind of vibe to him.
Almost. Right.
Almost. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't tip, right? Like he's finding that sort of perfect. And part of that is, you know, having worked on a sitcom for as many years as he did with Mr. Belvedere.
Sure.
I think that there's sort of him understanding theatricality in a way that is just really, really smart. And then Kenny, to your point, you know, 20 years of, he was a radio broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers. Mm-hmm. Like he just like, this is his lane. Like
completely.
He was born for this.
They do such an amazing thing. I'm sorry to jump back to Major League 2 for a second, but we're talking about Euchre and you were talking about Monty, who also reprises his role in Major League 2.
Well, I would
assume. There's a moment in Major. So in Major
they
League
were able
two,
to get him
in Major League 2. Bob Euchre, they are so bad that Bob Euchre starts heavily drinking. And at one point in the game, he passes out. And Monty is forced to take over the play-by-play duties. And what happens after that is, I believe it's the next play. Whoever is up hits the crap out of a ball. He hits a rocket to like right center field. And the outfielder runs and makes an absolutely insane play, an insane catch. And Monty, he announces it like so. Fly ball.
It's so good.
The rest of it is just showing you he's the color guy.
Yeah.
Bob Euchre is Monty's the announcer. Great. And they cannot switch. And it's just a fucking great example of that. Just it bumps Major League 2 up a little bit. The Euchre of it all.
But. I think I didn't mean to come that so hard to Major League 2. If there wasn't a Major League, Major League 2 would be a fine movie.
Sure.
But it's Major League 2. And
completely.
And
they tried to reproduce everything else. They gave him new characters, all the right kind of zany, and it got bigger. It got bigger.
I've talked about Major League 2 before because I think it's a really unique phenomenon. that Major League One comes out in 89, R-rated, I'd say a pretty hard R in terms of how, in terms of the language. Major League Two is PG-13. Major League Two is for children. Like, it is Charlie Sheen's story is about helping children.
Yep.
Yeah.
Rube is a character for children. Tanaka's a character for children. Serrano.
I can't imagine the Tanaka storyline has. It didn't hold up then, and it I can't imagine.
Marbles. No. And Serrano gives up voodoo for Buddhism, and he becomes a character for children. And I don't mean to knock it, but I don't mean to knock it, but I do feel like all the edges are sanded off completely. Of Major League Two in a really weird way. And it does speak to me to this mass phenomenon of 8 and 9 year olds getting indoctrinated to the world of Major League Two and Paramount deciding to make a movie for those kids who are now 12 and 13 that they can go and see, which is kind of crazy.
Well, I definitely saw it in the theater.
Me too.
There's two things that I wanted to say about that. First of all, you know, Kenny, we talked a little bit about this on the Ghostbusters 2 episode in terms of how
sequels
back then, you know, kind of a dirty word. People were not into franchises in the way that they are now, obviously. And seeing a sequel to Major League 5 years later, right? And the PG-13 version of it, you know, is sort of akin to, we talked a little bit about this on Ghostbusters 2, but, you know, what happened to the Lethal Weapon franchise as well, right? Where, you know, it ultimately becomes a family franchise, whether, you know, we like it or not, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder whether or not, I mean, it seems like that's what happened with Major League as well, right? Which is, they start to see sequels doing well, and they're like, fuck it, we'll do another one.
Yeah. But I also think that also just speaks to the just what happens with success.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, success has 1,000 fathers, and it's just like, you know, just where it's like, oh, this was successful. Great. Now there's a million more eyes on it. And now we have to make fucking damn sure that we recapture all the success. So because of that, there's a lot more people weighing in. There's a lot more people, you know, having an impact on it, which is unfortunately why the quality dips.
It becomes corporate too, right? Like once your corporate overlords start to tell you we can sell more X, Y, and Z if we do this, you're toast. Like there's nothing good comes from that. One last Euchre thing that I want to bring up is his improvising of the whiskey behind his ear that he does, which I think is fucking incredible.
Yes. He puts on as like cologne or something.
Yeah,
right?
It's cologne. Yeah.
Euchre, just oh my god!
What's
funny is, they do. There's a weird scene where it's like the one time we see him outside of the booth, they go to like his radio show.
Yeah.
For I forget a little bit, and you're like, oh yeah, wait, he's doing a radio show. They never come back to it. It seems like something that was kind of just. I forget what story point it helps, but
yeah, it was the bridge of point for that, sure. It was definitely the bridge of point.
I forget.
Yeah.
But it was called Chop Talk, Talking Chop, Talking Chop.
Yeah.
Talking Chop.
But honestly,
it reminds me of the shit we grew up with like Kiner's Corner.
Yeah, yeah,
like
right.
Totally. Show. Like, that's like, yeah.
What's great about the Euchre of it all in this movie is he honestly, especially once they start off, you know, spring training, he basically is like your narrator. He's like your device. He's your voiceover that, you know, I feel like we're always looking for in the stuff that we write. It's like, how can you have a voiceover that actually serves a purpose? Yep. It isn't just like someone just talking, you know, in the ether. And it's just, it's a great device. And I mean, I think that's why in almost every sports movie, and this always kind of rankles me sometimes, is like growing up, I loved the movie Little Giants as a kid. I saw it in theaters.
Me too. Love it.
Very similar. Hey, we have this good team. We have the shitty team isn't supposed to see. They do at the end. They beat the bad guys, basically. But it always crazy. Is they have an announcer at the game. I think it's Harry Shearer in the movie. And there's so many sports movies. You're like, why is there an announcer there? There's no world that there's never Little League announcers. There's never Pee Wee football announcers. But they serve the same purpose. They're the narrator of the movie. But in this movie, it just works because he's supposed to be there. And he's funny. And he gives you the info you need.
In 99, we did Mystery Alaska.
Sure.
Which really like contorts itself to have an announcer there, you know, to explain this final game. I think, do you guys have another movie where an announcer who serves a similar function is actually value add as opposed to just narrating the story?
I think
of the game?
The movie Necessary Roughness
is
Rob Schneider is the announcer. And he gets out, and he actually should be there because it's a college football team. And he actually does provide, because football, especially, you have way more players.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
Great movie. The cast is way bigger. You're following still a couple people, but I think that he does serve a similar purpose to Uecker, and is only like slightly lower than him. That to me is like, it's some of the funniest I've ever seen Rob Schneider in before, for sure, I think. And that movie still holds up, I think. And is a really, and if I looked it up, I'm sure it's probably like a year or two after this movie. So my guess was probably like, hey, let's make Major League, but
it's a football college, version.
Yeah. That's how it happened.
Craig, did you have one?
I'm trying to think. I think that Major League by far is the best use of it. Nothing jumps out to me. I agree. There's a lot of movies that use it, but it's bending over backwards to get it in there. And I don't like Little Giants is a great example, but I'm also thinking of, there's another one that's like, it's kids and it's like, it's not well done. It's like, they try to make it, they do 10,000 backflips to make it like, this is the big game. So we're going to have announcers and it doesn't never feel, it yeah. never feel I mean, real.
On a much smaller scale, A League of Their Own, another perfect movie, by the way.
For sure. That's a great announcer. Yeah.
A League of Their Own is an excellent announcer. Yeah. And he comes in, he gives much less backstory, but he gives kind of just enough. And I mean, I feel like I still to this day, I quote like 10 things he said. I feel like I say Dottie Henson and just yell it for no reason twice a day.
But I think that Bob,
I mean, the way he screams, Henson dropped the ball is just like, is the fucking
best. But I think that Bob Uecker was so good in this movie that he has caused for sports comedies to use announcers solely as like comedians. And it's not always great. Like for like the thing that keeps on jumping out to me is Dodgeball, which is like Bateman.
That's what I was going to say. Man.
Bateman
it's
and
a bad person.
And it's and it like they have some funny jokes. It's like ESPN the Ocho, which is a funny joke, like I thought. But it's there's no value added really. It's just kind of it's only the bit. It's not the story.
I mean, for comedic purposes, value added. I'm sorry, of comedic purposes, value added of an announcer is in Best in Show when it's
that's what I was
sure, right
say
of course
too.
I mean
I was gonna say Best in Show Best in Show
Fred Willard is amazing
Fred
Willard just absolutely is the funniest part of it
and the British really guy who's movie. Just like who's
just
the
along
best
for the ride and,
but then you have
and that's been trying to be emulated ever since I mean that's just what everyone's looking for
you take
dodgeball
it to its, you take it to its insane end point where you get to Pitch Perfect where Elizabeth Banks is doing it.
Yeah, right.
With John Michael Higgins.
Yep.
Who is announcing a cappella performances?
Good point. Yeah.
You know what's a great use of announcers is Naked Gun, where they have
good.
20 of them. Yeah. Talk about an opportunity for like a King Ralph to take out all the announcers at once if anything went wrong during that shoot.
Yeah, who gets put in there? Who's the King Ralph of it?
I don't know.
Oh man,
one thing that I wanted to bring up that I just thought was hilarious. It made me think of the when we were talking about merchandising earlier and just like the corporatization of shit. But so the vehicle that Willie Mays Hayes drives up in, you know, the VW Beetle with the Rolls Royce grill.
Yeah. Great.
Was apparently called the quote unquote elegant Beetle kit, and it was popular in the 70s and 80s. But then Rolls Royce sued, I guess it became very popular after this movie, and Rolls Royce sued people and they stopped doing it.
Amazing.
But I just love that there was like a kit and there was a moment when like that was the thing to get for your Beetle.
The 80s were, I mean, I don't know, it was the 80s. It was
just wild.
You know what's wild about Willie Mays Hayes? Is every other character?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not Serrano because it's but the other characters have a bit of a backstory, you know, or a bit of a life outside of baseball. You know where Rick Vaughn comes from. You know where Tom Berenger comes from. You know Dorn has been there for years. You know that Pedro Serrano comes from Cuba and is practicing voodoo. You know Harris has been there for years. Last leg. You know Tire World. Willie Mays Hayes exists as if he was just divine to be in that spot.
Yep.
You know, and he has no history. He's no. I always kind of pictured him as some guy who, and you see the shot of his apartment with the Willie Mays Hayes wall and the gloves. So that informs it a little bit. I always just kind of think he's like some guy who lived in some apartment in Chicago, like overlooked Wrigley Field, and just one day decided I'm going to be a baseball player. Like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
Where did he come from? He's so normal. Like, it's amazing. It's not like he's Serrano who could have been beamed down from another universe. He's just some normal fucking hucksterish guy. I am crazy about him.
Yeah.
And he winds up doing something like with so much heart at the end. He steals the base. Yeah. He does the slide. I love that slide.
I mean, I think that they, just in watching it, I was very aware of like the last game. All of the players have a little win. And yeah. It's like they all kind of, it's like Willie Mays, he steals the base. Serrano tells Joe Boo to fuck himself. He hits a two-run homer to tie the game in the seventh. Vaughn gets the big out at the end.
Dorn is on base. Dorn gets a two.
Dorn starts the rally, right? He's the one who he scores before Serrano. They all
Harris throws two thirds.
They all have just they all have like little wins along the way, just to complete their stories in such a great. Like, it's just. It's but just what's really lovely well
about that is,
really
to your point, what's lovely about that is, like, in movies, other movies in this genre, Little Giants, Ladybugs, which I've seen 100,000 times, Mighty Ducks, you pretty much only have goals to go off, right?
Sure.
Like, they pretty much, it's who scores these goals or who scores these touchdowns, and those are the ones you've decided get their little wins at the end. But this really appreciates knowing about baseball, to know how consequential it is for Dorn to get that two out hit in the seventh down two, you know, but you don't have to know, like the music clues you in how important it is. The, you know, the pointing to the dugout clues you in how important it is. And that's something I don't like about Major League Two also, because like they neuter these characters down to the point where Dorn's win is a hit by pitch.
Yeah.
Fuck you guys.
Oh no, completely. It's not in the same realm.
No,
it's just something
I know you're not saying it is, but like I even love Roger Dorn, right? I love fucking Bob Harris. They don't even ever use his name. What's Harris' first name? Harris.
I think it's Ed.
I don't think. Yeah, it's Ed.
Is it Ed?
I don't know.
Steve? It's Ed.
It's Ed.
It's Ed.
Wow.
His name is Ed Harris.
I'm like 90% sure.
Ed Harris is a real guy. He was in the right stuff.
I know. Hold on a second.
Great, that's a great
bit. His name's Eddie Harris. His name is Eddie Harris.
That's like the name of someone like Mikey Shannon today. It's Mikey Shannon. Yeah. Just approximately equivalent actor. But I don't know. I love what you're talking about, Matt. I love every little victory all these guys get. They seem appropriate for their characters.
I also really love, and again, this is a tone thing, but I love like the shitty plane that they have and then the shitty bus that they have. Like, it's just great, like visual gag humor that doesn't go to full caricature, but just like lives in this great space.
You know, it's just added value just to get you on board with that.
They're using the story today.
It does a great job.
If you think about it, I don't know if you guys watch Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso is
a major league story set in, I love Ted Lasso. I thought it was fantastic, but I'm just saying it's like taking the Three Amigos and putting it in space. That's the Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
Three Amigos in space. What?
Galaxy Quest, which is fantastic.
Is that true? Same exact story.
It's the same story.
But hey. And it's not a bad thing.
Both are excellent.
I mean,
look, Major League is great. Ted Lasso is great. Three Amigos is great. And Galaxy Quest is great.
Galaxy Quest is 99. We did it a couple weeks ago. Three Amigos might be 89, Phil. Is it?
It's not. It's earlier. I think it's like 86 or 87.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a couple other
things. 86.
Worth talking about just in terms of story, I guess, to a certain degree, although we've hit most of this stuff, but I just love the scene where Taylor goes to the library to confront Lynn, it seems. About coming to the baseball game to see him play. I think is it around that point, if I'm not mistaken, or is that earlier?
I don't think she is, but when he goes to the library, she hasn't gotten to the game yet. Yeah, this is just that he saw her at the restaurant. This is the follow-up.
Right. So he goes to the library, which is a great scene.
She gave him the fake number.
He knew
it was going to be a fake number because he called from outside the library, which is a nice little
– Yes.
It makes him smart.
Yeah.
But it makes – he makes sure that he doesn't, you know – go in there with a half-cocked gun, which I love too.
But I love that scene in the library. It does have. Is this the line? Is it? Books are my life
books
now.
My
is
life
it
now, it's yeah, in that yeah. scene?
Books yeah. are my yeah. life now.
But
it also has her best line,
which is,
"I had a much better body than her."
Yeah. I did love his line leading up to that, though, which is, right. "She said she had a better body than you. I was defending your honor," which is
amazing
line. "I have a much better body than you."
Yeah,
and she yeah. calls she calls the slightest miss fuel injection. Yeah. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I like that she goes, "That's bullshit. I have a much better body with her body than her," which makes me think. So she knew this story that he was screwing around with.
Yeah. And I mean, way, across the board, there's this great extra work across the board. The entire library turns, gives me a look.
Yes.
There's great, there's lots of extras doing a lot of work in this movie, and they all crushed it.
Speaking of everyone moving in unison, there's that great moment in the locker room when they all give her the.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But the thing about Lynn's character, there's a couple head scratchers, which is that she's dedicated, it seems, to being a librarian now. She's marrying some rich miser. I don't quite understand. She used to be an Olympic
swimmer. Yes.
She's really living a lot of lives.
She's wearing a lot of hats.
It feels like her license plate used to be swim, and then she switched it over to read.
I think that one of my biggest takeaways from this viewing was that Berenger not only once but twice just straight up breaks into her apartment and is like, "Hey, here's the deal. I'm kind of here." And I remember, and I definitely felt for the first time in watching this movie, for the first time, a little icky about the second time. The first time was like, I don't think he was expecting to go into her apartment and stuff. That was like he was going to knock on the door. The second time, he straight up just breaks into her apartment. He's like, "Hey, here's the deal." And it's just like,
yeah.
And then she does, you know, get into it. There's for sure a giant gray line, or I guess not a gray line. There's a fucking giant line that he just broke into the second time.
Yeah.
And it's not cool. And then, but then when she gets into it, you're like, okay. And at the end, it's okay. I think that might even be their last scene together until the end.
I think it is, yeah.
He goes to her apartment when she leaves in the morning.
Yeah, it's empty, right? Yeah.
There's some shit that you know, if this weren't my movie, and it is my movie, but if this weren't my movie, I would be harder on. Like, I would be harder on everything Rachel Phelps, right? Like, making the villain one of the only female characters in the movie, and then using her naked body as motivation, not the best.
Sure.
But it's my movie, so I don't care. Which I think is, you know. But I've come down on worse movies for smaller smaller transgressions.
I also just want to say the scene when he goes to the second time he goes to her apartment is a great scene for a bunch of reasons. But what I love is when she tells the story about the surprise party.
Oh, it's so good.
And it's a lawyer with a you know. Paternity suit.
That was a hoax.
But I just think that like that type of specificity and dimension to a movie like this, just it to everyone's point, which we've been saying the whole time, if this movie was made today, would not have that.
Yes,
you know what I mean. Yeah. It would not have that level of, quite frankly, gravity. I mean that's a real kind of gut punch moment where, I mean, at least for me. It makes you lose respect for Taylor in that moment. And he's, you know, he's fighting his way back into her good graces in that scene. And he does so, I mean, I guess relatively effectively because they sleep together. But I just think that it's a real moment of like, this guy kind of was a dirtbag. I mean, he was a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Completely. And I think that they do. And there's another little moment in there when, because you're kind of like, wait, why is he winning her over in this moment? And it's like, clearly she, you know, is still into him in like a small way. He kind of is like breaking her down. And then I think they start to kiss. Cause I think that they bring up the Moby Dick.
It's so good.
He's like, "I read it." And then they start to kiss and she pulls away. And for a brief moment, she's like, "Wait, basically, I forgot the line." It's about like, you know, how does Moby Dick end or who kills or who saves Ishmael?
Who saves Ahab?
And then he like in a great piece of Berenger acting, locates it, stumbles on it because he's got sex on the brain, and then she gets it out, and then she's
But I would actually say that the one of the best parts of the scene is the very last line where she says, "This doesn't change anything. We were always good at this." Again, that's a fucking great line.
It earns like why that happened just now and stuff. Yeah.
But you know, the thing that really got the thing that really moved the ball forward that I love too, that broke her down after that, after she put the walls up with the surprise party, was when he says, "Do your parents like this guy?" And she goes, "Euro is their favorite." There's something about that moment where I'm like, all right. She's been hearing about him. He's constantly in her mind. Like he is charming as shit. Like he obviously is like won over her family and like. It's just these little moments, but I love what is it? It's Ku Klux. It's something Craig's coffin. It was
something like that. Yeah.
None of us have read Moby Dick. Okay, cool.
No,
but I wanted to say that
like watching visually.
I don't want to belabor the point, but it's just this relationship and these scenes are what really put this movie into another caliber for me. Like, and that, I mean, not to say that the jokes aren't there, and the jokes are there, and it's a very funny movie, and I get all of that stuff. But like, that's what puts this movie into a completely different category for me. It's like, it's the fact that the movie goes there and has the balls to like, you know, whether or not I have issues with Lynn's backstory and some of her like, what have you, Renee Russo and the lines that she has, like you just, you know, she can, that there's just the dimension that they give these people are just tremendous.
I mean, and that's completely, I think that's a big reason why Major League 2 doesn't work nearly as well is they tried to do that with Charlie Sheen and his ex-girlfriend in Major League 2. And not only did they not have nearly the same chemistry that Berenger and Rene Russo had, but they didn't really give her much of anything other than she kind of likes kids and he's kind of changed. There's no nuance to it. There's nothing, you know, there are no killer lines in that. They're like, oh man, okay, you get why they used to work, that there's a half a dozen instances of this movie and it's why it does work.
They build a whole world of their backstory.
Who plays his girlfriend? Is it?
In Major League 2, it's his ex-girlfriend. It's like his ex-girlfriend who I think was like when he was like a biker guy or something like that. And then she kind of works with like underprivileged youth.
And he's turned into like a corporate guy. Yeah, so he's like he's become a big star, and he's sanded up all of his edges, and he's dating some babe who does marketing.
Yes,
interesting.
Yeah. Doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It's like, you know, the movie's fine. But another thing I like about this movie is, despite all of, put it this way, I like this movie better than Bull Durham for a lot of reasons, but one of the big reasons is it doesn't shy away from the catharsis of actually having them win the big game. Like my feeling about Bull Durham is like it's almost embarrassed to be a baseball movie, right? Like, and I've heard that so many times, it's not really a baseball movie, it's really a romantic comedy, you know, set in and around the world of baseball about these three characters. And it is a great movie, it is a lovely movie. But I love that Major League takes you to the end of this team's journey and lets you win the game with them. It feels right to me.
I will say this, though, about Major League 2, which is in the beginning of Major League 2, correct me if I'm wrong, but they say that the team got like swept immediately.
Drives me nuts.
I actually think that's great. I think that's what would happen. Like, I'm being very serious. Like, I think that it's so cool that they have this big moment, but it's not the World Series. Like, they didn't win the championship. Like, there's still more to be done. I think that's a good setup.
I don't want Sopranos 2 to come out and be like, so James Gandolfini was actually alive, and they didn't, now here's how he's living.
Sure.
It was fine with me knowing that they won the pennant, because the whole movie, it's the Indians haven't won a pennant in a long time. You know, completely. That's always been the thing.
And I think, Kenny, what you just said too is like when they win, because most sports movies, 95% of them, they do win at the end, right?
But it's almost like the shameful thing to have the team care about.
Sure. Yeah. But this one is, you're so on board with everything else. And you've honestly, just because of the way the movie's put together, because of the performances, because it's a really fucking tight script. You feel absolute joy when they win, as opposed to just, it was expected they were going to win the whole time, which in watching, you're probably like, yeah, they're probably going to win at the end. it doesn't matter in this movie because you feel it. And this is the 100th time I've seen this movie. I still felt excited for the last game. I still felt when they win, you still get like the feelings that you're hoping to get. It just works. It just kind of all comes together at the end. Because
it's such a good movie. I think they've built it in a way that winning is not a given,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Little Big League, for instance, they don't win.
No.
And it still has this great ending and it's very cathartic, but that I think elevates that movie above other movies like that.
Agreed.
For instance, right?
Mm-hmm. I would say the same thing about A League of Their Own.
Yes.
A League of Their Own.
Very much.
Yes, exactly. Or, you know, Bad News Bears, they don't win. So there are a lot of these movies, like sports movies, where the moral is try your best, you know, solve your personal Rocky, but it's not so important that you win the game. So I think in a movie this good, it is not completely expected. Another movie, TV show that did this, and I was shocked, delighted when they did it, was Season 1 of Friday Night Lights. That did not seem like a show where the team wins in the end.
Yeah.
And it felt so fucking good.
Yeah.
To have them actually win. So,
and that's okay. And honestly, I feel like that's okay that happens. And I feel like we're so programmed to be like, oh, that's like kind of like cheesy. It's okay for a happy ending. It's okay to feel happy. It's okay like for good things to happen to people. I don't know. I think it is
a good story when a group of people band together and succeed and like give them sacrifice parts of themselves for the whole. That's wonderful in its own way. So that's the movie. What do you think, Phil?
There it is.
I think we're 99s all around. What do you think?
I think you guys are 99s.
I was talking to these two. But I'm 99 then, 99 now, 99 forever.
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got to be 99 for sure then, 99 forever, maybe a 98 because her license plate says Rio.
that could knock it down a point.
I mean, as I said earlier, I have a different relationship with this movie than you guys do. In 89, I probably would have given it a 75. Before this podcast, I probably would have given it an 82, but you guys have swayed me. I'm at a 90 now.
That's pretty good.
I feel good.
Yeah.
I feel good
for a hockey fan from Canada, that's pretty good.
Yeah, great. Can I ask what you gave Mystery Alaska?
I think we were in the 60s, okay. I think.
All right, that makes me feel better.
Like you might. I thought we were beneath 50, both of us.
I don't think so.
Well, we didn't.
I think that Mystery Alaska was. When did Mystery Alaska come out? It was
99.
Yeah.
That was for sure. So we were like, 17 at the time. I remember being very excited by that movie and then walking out and being like, that was just underwhelming.
Yeah.
Exciting.
I had never seen it when we did that.
Who wrote Mystery Alaska? It's a big
David E. Kelly.
David E. Kelly.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
That's right. Okay.
Are you guys? His two 99 films. Kenny loves his other one, though.
What are his two lake-based 99 films?
Yeah.
So basically, he got a place.
He got a lake house. He got a lake house, 100%.
Sitting there with Michelle Pfeiffer in the summer saying, I think there's a movie here. Then the leaves fall. The weather turns. this is kind of apropos of nothing, but is hockey your number two favorite sport?
Hockey, it depends on the state of the Islanders. We're giant Islanders fans. This past year, the Islanders made the Eastern Conference Finals. And so hockey became like my number one for a few months. And my kids were on board, especially because of the pandemic. There was no sports for so long. Yeah. And my kids, for the first day, we were super invested. They'd watch the games with me. It became this like big feeling where I just haven't had that with the Mets, you know, since I've had kids. And so it definitely like took over. I think that it's baseball and hockey kind of goes up and down depending on how much I'm into it for the particular season. For sure.
I mean, I think for me, like I could watch, watch any Islander game that I can, but I'll put on the most random baseball game and be perfectly happy. And I won't necessarily watch like two random hockey teams play.
Yeah, the pandemic was interesting in the sense that I found that the only sport that translated well to pandemic was basketball.
And Dave,
in terms of like the actual way that it, like the bubble itself, the bubble was cool. Worked.
Yeah,
it worked.
Basketball.
Yeah, I thought so too.
It didn't work for hockey and baseball. You just can't fill the stands with like fucking cardboard cut. Like it just doesn't work. At least for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that honestly, I was just so happy just to have any kind of sports. So I was going to watch anything that was happening. And just the fact that the Islanders, for the first time in, was it 27 years, made the Eastern Conference Finals. That was like a big event. And really for like a solid 6 weeks or 5 weeks of the playoffs that we were involved in, it was just, you know, probably the highlight of the last 9 months, I'd say, of my life.
Why the Islanders over the Rangers, out of curiosity?
So we're from Long Island. And so we grew up the town over from where the Islanders play, Nassau Coliseum. So we could, like, you know, walk to the game if we wanted to. Yeah.
And it was really, you guys could walk to the game?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely walked home before as like an adult. And and so it was also a much more, it was a really accessible thing. It was like, you know, like we were growing up on Long Island, like that was, it's the one Long Island actual team, right?
Yeah, it is.
And so, and the Rangers are more like, it's Manhattan, it's more like big city. And so this was more like, you know, they're from the town over. The ticket prices are a fraction of what they are to see the Rangers.
Right. Like we could go, so like you could go like the night after school. And like, you know, like with your, you know, and it was fine, you know, it wasn't like huge deal to go. So it was always acceptable.
Yeah. And honestly, in a weird way too, it was like a much more like small town situation. Like we would go and like, even like in college and then after we'd go to games and you go across the street. So Hofstra University is right over there too. You go across the street to the Hofstra bars and the Islanders are like hanging out in the bars there. It's
that
like
is
a real
so cool.
Yeah.
It's a real smaller town situation that I think most sports franchises kind of have. And now obviously they play their games, you know, in Brooklyn at Barclays, and now they're moving again. But so that's been a mess.
Where are they moving? I didn't know that.
They made a new arena like outside of like Belmont Park where the horse track is.
I have asked Kenny this in the past, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, just because I've never thought about it on the hockey side of things. I know that like the Mets versus the Yankees, like those are camps. You're in one camp or the other.
Yeah.
Is it the same with the Rangers and the Islanders?
It's worse. Just as bad or worse?
It's definitely worse. Islanders versus Rangers is worse. Because Mets and
Yankees. The Rangers are bar none my most hated sports franchise.
Oh my God.
And it's to the point where growing up the games, like you go to, it's basically like hockey and also just the sport in general. Like the fans are just more, they're more like diehard, I think, just the hockey. Especially like the games in the Nassau Coliseum, there's like, you know, it holds like 14,000-15,000 maybe. Those are like the fans of the team, right? And so they go to all the games. And so if you go to an Islanders-Rangers game or even an Islanders-Flyers games, you are guaranteed to see not one but probably two legit fistfights in front of them.
Wow.
Like I guaranteed, and that doesn't happen. Mets, Yankees,
even Islanders, Flyers.
Oh, for sure.
Islanders, Flyers. We went back to back opening days. Nice. Islanders, Flyers. One game in particular, before the puck was dropped, you just look over and you just see people falling off each other,
tumbling down
the arena, massive brawls.
Yeah,
massive
Islanders, brawl. Bruins.
No,
not as bad.
Flyers, but more specifically, Islanders,
I will say,
Rangers.
Like, I'm a Yankee fan, and I almost always also root for the Mets. Like I hope that they win unless they're playing the Yankees always. And my father is a gigantic Rangers fan and I can't root for the Rangers ever. Like I just, and I love my dad. We're cool. I just like, I cannot root for them.
The thing is, and you guys know this, and I hope, you know, you're not insulted, but it's just the facts. No one cares about the Islanders. And that's why you hate everybody else so much. Because, like, I don't think Rangers fans even think too hard about the Islanders. I don't think
they do. Rangers fans do, because they also have – I don't think that Yankees fans think about Mets fans, because Yankees have just won so much.
That's true.
The Rangers haven't won so much. They've won one cup in the last seven years.
Are you trying to say that your father doesn't think about me?
That's fucked up. We'll have you back for Field of Dreams. What I really mean is, in your school, obviously, in my school, you'd have Mets fans and Yankees fans sitting next to each other in the cafeteria. You'd have Giants fans and Jets fans sitting next to each other in the cafeteria. There were no Islanders fans in my cafeteria because just like there were no Nets fans in my with an N because New York, the city, and Westchester just didn't acknowledge the Jersey teams and Long Island a potential team you could root for.
Yeah.
So I'm sure the Rangers fans in your life from Long Island are like akin to like, you know, fucking atheists and, you know, horrendous in Israel.
They're horrendous people.
I'm sure they're monsters.
They're bad, bad, bad people.
Well, you brought up Jersey, but like, are the Devils, was that an issue for you guys? I mean, the Devils
won a bunch of cups. Yeah, it was really just Islanders, it was really just Islanders, Rangers. And it was,
I mean, you didn't know one Devil fan. Except maybe your worst front-running asshole person you ever met.
But also, it was like the Islanders didn't, like, especially when we were kids, like, you know, before, like, my parents moved to Long Island in 82. That was the last year of the four cups that the Islanders won in a row. And I think at the time, too, I don't think, unless you lived on Long Island or had a connection there, you didn't like the Islanders. It wasn't like you weren't a fan of them. It wasn't like they didn't have Gretzky. They didn't have, you know, who took over and, like, you know, they won a bunch of cups and stuff. You didn't have, like, Mario Lemieux. They didn't really have that bossy and, like, you know, I was like from their star power, but he had a kind of a shorter career where you only liked the Islanders if you grew up and you were from Long Island. They didn't travel well, like to the point where Craig and I, we go to the Islanders play one game a year against the Kings in LA every year. We go to it every single year. Whenever the Islanders score, we go to it together. We stand up and we cheer, and you can count. It is me, Craig, 10 other Islander fans, and Kevin Connolly, those are the only people you see.
Huge Islander fan, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the only people you see at the Kings Islander games every year. There's 12 of us out here.
Meanwhile, have you been to a Kings Rangers game?
No, I never.
Don't think so. But I'd imagine there's a lot more
30% Rangers fans.
Yeah, right.
I'd imagine there's a lot more.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. Same with go ahead.
I will say also, you know, I have been to almost every time the Leafs play here, I will go and see them play. And half the Staples Center is filled with Canadians that are rooting for, like, when they're chanting "Go Kings Go," you can barely hear it because the Leafs people are saying it. Like, it's kind of insane. It speaks more to how many Canadians live in Los Angeles than there is anything else. But it is it's pretty insane.
Oh, there are tons.
How are you liking Tavares so far, Phil?
Okay. I mean, listen, the Leafs are a problem. I mean, they've been a problem we had a pretty good run when I was in universities, you know, the Sundin years when, like, they would get to the, you know, they'd get pretty far. And even the Gilmore years with Wendell, like, those were good years.
They made the finals one year, right? Didn't they? Did they make the finals one year or no?
They never made the finals.
Never made the finals. Yeah. I basically like became a pariah among my close friends because I was the one person who didn't want to, like, murder JT when he left. I was basically like,
I'm still upset about it.
You know, it's kind of like, it's a sport. He went back to his hometown team.
It's not about that. He was going to stay on the Islanders and he waited to the last minute.
That's amazing.
I feel like few of my close friends, like, didn't talk to me for a little bit because I wasn't like, I want to actually physically hurt this person.
I will say that the thing about the Islanders that I've always thought, and this might seem totally random, but their colors are so 70s, like that orange. Well,
they're so New York, though.
It's amazing. Yeah. I love it. Like, I love
the colors. Mets colors,
yeah,
the Knicks
colors.
Colors,
right?
It's right, right.
Yep.
It's just those are actually like the New York City colors, for better or worse. But it is this like beautiful 70s thing they have going. All those teams have going on.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, guys, this was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. We could talk for another 3 hours about Major League if you'd like. We have more.
Well, hold on. I guess while we have you, did anybody see the third Major League film?
I actually never have. I never have either.
I've only seen the beginning because a buddy of ours.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Isn't a good buddy of ours, a comedy writer, Joe Kelly, actually
co-created Ted Lasso.
Who co-created Ted Lasso.
That's funny.
He is in the cold open of Major League 3. He's a catcher who goes over. I think he happened to be, I think they were shooting in Atlanta.
They were shooting in Atlanta and they needed.
And he happened to like, they needed athletes. And so he is the catcher who goes to the mound visit, I think, in the very first game. So I've seen that scene of Major League 3. I'm pretty sure it's a minor league team. And Scott Bakula,
Unnecessary
roughness is the lead.
It is
the idea.
It's amazing that I love Major League so much, and I'm defending Major League 2, and I've never seen Major League 3.
I've never seen Major League 3, too. The idea that, like, and these are mostly Major League 2 guys. It's like Dorn and a lot of Major League 2 guys, I think, who I also have, like, affinity for. The idea that these guys went back to the minors and I'm supposed to watch that in a movie was too much for me. Yeah, I don't need to see that. I don't need to see that. It's like depressing.
Fool me twice. Not fool me three times.
Right, it is like it is Dorn. I mean, Berenger's not in it. Is even Omar Epps in it?
Let me look it up.
Anyone is in Major League 3. I think the bad guy is Jefferson from. Is the bad guy Jefferson from Married with Children?
Oh, it's Jefferson. Scott Bakula, Corbin Burnson, Dennis Haybert is in it.
Yeah, so Serrano has to go back to the. I hate that. That's worse than getting swept in the series after the first one.
But those are the only people. They didn't even get. They didn't even get the announcer back. They didn't get Uecker back.
They didn't get Uecker back. Well, Uecker's not going to do minor league games.
That would have been. That would have been too unbelievable.
That's a bridge too far.
Yeah.
I didn't even like Bakula doing it because he was so great in. Necessary Roughness.
Yeah, he's a football guy.
But you know who's really good in two. Jack Parkman.
Sure.
Parkman's a great bad guy.
A worthy successor to Clue Haywood. Parkman. The women love that little shimmy he does. So.
Yep.
Parkman.
He's the Clue Haywood of the second movie. He's on the White Sox. He is Clue Haywood with less hair, but he's like somehow more revolting.
Yeah.
And he hits they treat him as if he's a ladies' man. And when he hits a home run, he does a little shimmy.
He has an actual arc in Major League 2. He starts off on the Indians.
Yeah, right.
And then they trade him.
I forgot that. Little reverse out of Banks there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Great call.
Which I believe is how it was pitched.
So this is – I'm just going to assume that this is your favorite baseball movie, right? Like there isn't any question.
100%.
Not me.
And second would be Little – A League of Their Own, and then Little Big League, probably vying for it.
Field of Dreams is definitely my favorite, but these are not even. They shouldn't even be considered baseball movies. They're doing such different things. Field of Dreams in this, and then A League of Their Own would be my third. I think I consider
Field of Dreams way less of a baseball movie than I think most people. I mean, Field of Dreams is like a road trip movie. Yeah. Really, it's
baseball's incidental.
Obviously, like. It comes back to baseball at the end.
Family
it's never about the stakes. Have nothing to do with baseball. It's really just like this guy's journey.
Field of Dreams.
I love it, but it's different.
Is all right. So the only real major religion like started in America is Mormonism, and then like Scientology. Field of Dreams is about America's religious experience with baseball.
Right.
It's about spirituality, for sure.
Yeah. Which is something that like I feel. Like, or I felt very strongly as a kid, like not particularly, we'll talk about this when we do 89 with Field of Dreams, but Field of Dreams is like as much a part of my like person as this movie, but it's also serious. So like,
well, I was saying to Kenny, so I watched Field of Dreams for the first time. I had never seen it. I watched it maybe 2 months ago. I just was like, well, this is on and I'll watch it. And I thought it was great. Like, I mean, I look forward to our episode when we do it, but I was just like, why does everyone cry at this movie? Like, as I was watching it, I was hold on.
I don't want to give away the answer.
I don't really get it. I don't know why anybody cries at this film. And then literally the last moment, just tears. Yeah. I was just like just him asking his dad to, you're just like,
that's one of the best line reads in movie history.
It gets caught in his throat.
Yep. It's caught in his throat. It's
amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the moment where Costner overtakes Berenger.
Yeah.
That's the moment.
Yes. Yes.
You could see Berenger watching that and just going.
Oh. I'm gonna throw out a hot take.
Yeah.
Field of Dreams. Truly, like I think it's my favorite movie. I think Berenger could have done it.
No way.
I think Berenger could have handled it.
You think Berenger and James Earl Jones could have been in season? I don't know, man.
Those are like my two dads, right? Berenger and Costner. You know, it's like in sports. I don't know if you guys feel this, but But Matt, you like the same teams I like. I have like a paternal relationship with Davey Johnson and Bill Parcells.
They don't know. Okay.
No, I'm the product of a one night stand. But they're like my dads. Like I still see them, and even like kind of like Bobby Valentine's like my weird uncle. Like no matter what they do, it's like those guys are members of my family. And yeah. I've always felt that way about Costner because Costner's in so many movies from my formative years that are important to me. Yeah. And Berenger because he's Jake Taylor. He's mine forever. Do you guys have people like that?
Whew. Oh boy.
Great question. I mean, I definitely feel that way about all sports figures that I grew up for sure. As far as like actors and actresses go, I'm not sure I have that.
This is a fucking lame answer, but I'm going to give it anyway, just because I think Tom Hanks is everyone's dad, Hanks and there's something of
her dad.
Yeah.
He's probably up there. But Kenny, I do think it's interesting, like the Kevin Costner thing, and I look forward to. I mean, we have two Kevin Costner films in '99: Message in a Bottle and For Love of the Game. So
which we haven't done.
For Love of the Game.
Yeah.
Never seen it. Maybe it's great.
I saw it on a plane.
And then we have obviously Field of Dreams in '89. Like Kevin Costner, I really want a renaissance for that guy. Like I just feel like
isn't he having one right now? Isn't he on Yellowstone?
Yellowstone, I guess. I've never seen the show.
I've never seen it, but from what I hear, people like it.
People like it. It's true. And I mean, I don't mean to shit on it. I just don't really know it. But
I couldn't tell you what it's about, though.
It's about a family. It's about a big national park.
Yellowstone.
I'll throw something out about For Love of the Game. For Love of the Game, if executed properly, could have been a Best Picture winner because Slumdog Millionaire is the exact same movie mm-hmm. and won Best Picture.
Yeah.
They just kind of fucked up what they were doing.
No, I think the idea of facts,
but there is something to it.
The organizing principle of For Love of the Game, which is fucking brilliant, and like a life broken up into nine innings is fucking genius.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I think Sam Raimi is an inspired choice, but the movie I guess it's just very maudlin, and I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Not to talk about every movie of all time, but I mean, Craig, I'm going to
go ahead.
Cue you, and there were a couple of this happened twice on the Yankees, where old pitchers at the end of their career threw a no hitter. Like if you did this with Dwight Gooden, I would love to see it.
Yeah, sure.
And if you did it with David Wells, you could do it that as well. Like these guys you'd never expect to be able to throw a no hitter. There is something kind of thrilling about some guy 38, 37, 38.
David Wells threw a perfect game. He did what the game is.
But you're basically saying For Love of the Game and Slumdog Millionaire are kind of also like Three Amigos. Galaxy Quest type of situation.
Galaxy Quest.
Exactly like that. Yes. Right. Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Amazing. Well, I look forward to talking about For Love of the Game. I want to watch it. I'm curious.
I saw it when it came out. Yeah. I don't know it as well.
Should you guys continue the sports stuff and come back for it? And then we can talk Costa.
We will come back whenever you want. You guys are great.
Please.
All right.
Happy. Yeah, we should do it soon. I mean, I would love to. I mean, I think more than anything, it's just such a drastic. I mean, and not to belabor the point, but like again, a totally different baseball take.
Yes,
you know, a completely different movie.
Yeah.
Like the flexibility of this sport, I think, is sort of the point that we are all making, which is it just fits into life in ways that's just a lot more flexible than any other sport.
Agreed,
for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was fucking great.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Costner and for Love the Game too. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's
1989. Baby fish mouth. Baby fish mouth.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.